I met with an advisor who, and he's probably one of our biggest allocators now, but he told me he had never had any private investments in his client portfolios. Someone else in his branch, he works for one of the big firms in the U.S., suggested he meet with one of our guys in the field, and he took the meeting, and he said it totally changed his thinking because he learned about the asset classes, how they fit in the portfolio, how they act as diversifiers. But probably as essential, our wholesaler went with him to meet with clients. And after five or six of those meetings, he had the confidence to be able to talk about it himself. But there's probably no way he would have allocated without that confidence. And I completely get it. So when we speak about education, it's not just the formal education of teaching about the structure and the investments. It's also how do you answer the questions and how do you talk about it to your clients in a simple way so that they'll really understand all the way around. And that's what we do. To me, the day-to-day meeting with advisors is probably the most essential part of the education process.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square, where I sit down with leaders across private markets. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Joan Slowitar, Global Head of Private Wealth at Blackstone. Under Joan's leadership, Blackstone Private Wealth has emerged as the clear leader with more than $250 billion of assets under management and is a pioneer in broadening access to private investments with a specific focus on serving the financial advisor as their customer. In nearly every conversation I have, Blackstone comes up as the firm that others want to emulate, and I'm very excited to sit down with Joan to learn more about how she and her team at Blackstone have built this great platform. During our conversation, we discuss Joan's career, her path to Blackstone, and the various roles she's held at the firm, Blackstone's views on the future of private markets and the opportunities ahead, and what Joan and Blackstone have learned about working with financial advisors and introducing alts to them and their clients. I recorded this episode in Joan's Manhattan office in November of 2024. The full episode is available on the Juniper Square YouTube page. If you haven't checked it out, I'd encourage you to do so. This episode and all other episodes are available there for you to watch. As we wrap up the year, I'm humbled by the outpouring of support I've received from all of you since starting this podcast. My original goal was simple: record conversations with industry leaders and share their stories and the lessons they have learned with others. The idea was born not out of a desire to be a podcast host, but rather an opportunity to help educate my colleagues and industry peers. This has proven to be a very effective tool, and each email or LinkedIn post I receive from you motivates and reinforces the importance of building community and sharing knowledge. I've heard that some of the snippets from the podcast episodes have been used to help teams learn about the market, to help capital raisers raise money, and to help investors write investment committee memos. Most importantly, these episodes are to help you learn about the journey of private markets leaders, their companies, and what they see as the greatest challenges and opportunities ahead. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. Juniper Square is the leading provider of technology and third-party administration to private markets GPs and is trusted by more than 2,100 GPs across real estate, private equity, private credit, infrastructure, venture capital, crypto, and more. To learn more about Juniper Square, you can drop me an email at brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com or visit junipersquare.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends and colleagues and be sure to follow the episodes on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and subscribe via YouTube. I've got some great episodes in store for 2025 and I greatly appreciate your continued support. Let's get into it. Joan, it's so great to be here in your offices here in New York City. Thank you for hosting us.
Well, thank you, Brandon, for having me.
So we're recording this in your office in New York City, in Blackstone's offices. And help our listeners, you know, I think it's an interesting place to start. Help our listeners understand kind of what your office means to you. We're surrounded by, you know, some really interesting kind of photos and memorabilia that I'm sure is really important. Maybe kind of give us a quick tour de force here.
Yeah, sure. I think when you work as long as I've worked, you accumulate a lot of stuff like that. So I have photos of me with some past U.S. presidents and my family. There are what used to be called deal toys, including Blackstone's tombstone that looks like a tuxedo. That one's very special to me. There's some awards mixed in there, some not-for-profit photos. And one of the most special, I think, is this letter that I had written to a childhood friend's grandfather who visited our, I believe, first grade classroom, talked to us about Wall Street. I sent him this letter thanking him, telling him how interesting it was. He apparently saved it. My friend was cleaning out his house, found it, and sent it to me.
That's an amazing letter. And for our listeners who aren't watching this, the letter's written in cursive, which we were talking before we started recording, I think is becoming a lost art form these days.
Yes.
So beautiful handwriting.
Thank you.
So you've been at Blackstone since 2007, correct?
Correct.
So let's talk a little bit about kind of the lead up. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about Blackstone and your career here and what you're doing around private wealth. But before we do, sounds like from first grade onwards, you were very interested in finance. So maybe start kind of where'd you grow up and how did you get interested in finance and what was the journey that got you here?
My undergrad major was within the business school, MIS, which is coding and system design. And one of my first projects was to build a merger model on a mainframe computer. So talk about a lost art.
Exactly.
Not sure those even exist anymore.
No, I don't think they exist anymore.
And so that was really the path of travel. I loved it. I loved the analytical framework coupled with markets and, you know, strategy discussion, meeting with institutional investors. And so I did that for a very long time.
So you studied management information system. So help me understand, how did you go from that as your area of study to wanting to be on Wall Street? Because those two things don't necessarily, at least in my head, go hand in hand.
I think they do more than you would think. So it was housed within the business school.
Okay.
And so I did take all of the basics around finance and accounting and marketing and management. But I think there's a lot of similarity between coding and modeling and the analytical component of it. And then I had a general interest in markets and business, but I really didn't know exactly what that meant. So I wasn't seeking an equity research role. I was very generally looking for a role on Wall Street. And it happened that I did land that role, and it was fortuitous for me. I loved it and pursued that as a career. But I didn't go out saying, I want to work in equity research.
Talk to me a little bit about kind of Wall Street. I'm curious, what was your perception of Wall Street before you got there? And then how did that compare or contrast to the reality of being on Wall Street as a, you know, new graduate, you know, newly minted Wall Street, you know, banker, if you will?
I think my perception was these are super smart people. It was definitely daunting. I thought it might be a little scary and intimidating, especially coming from a SUNY school. I had the impression everyone else was coming from an Ivy League school and the like. But I think when I landed, I found people are just people at the end of the day. And as I say to my team here, everything is learnable. We're not doing anything that's rocket science. So it took me a while, really, to get my footing and to learn what I needed to learn. So I would say my initial impressions were different than my perception going in, but those initial impressions have really stood the test of time.
And was your family, was this like an accepted path? If you're the first one to graduate and now you're going on Wall Street, was this seen as, you know, you've made it? What was the perception of Wall Street?
Yeah, I mean, my parents were so proud of me. I think they would have been proud probably regardless of what I did, but they really followed my path. And as an equities analyst, you're a publishing analyst, you're often quoted in newspapers, you're on TV, at least back then that was the case. And I found years later, my dad had clipped probably every single article that I was quoted in. It was very cute. So they were super proud.
That's so cool. I think we were joking before we started recording, but it's a good reminder to not throw away the stuff that your children do, because those keepsakes will be very, very nostalgic one day. So you started your career. Now let's talk about what did you do from the time that you landed on Wall Street to the time that you joined Blackstone in 2007?
Yeah. So the path of travel, I was at first Boston and then I left left.
Okay.
I was working at that time for the top analyst covering the insurance sector, and we moved to DLJ. DLJ at the time was owned by the Equitable, which was going through a very difficult period. Dick Jenrette, one of the founders of DLJ, had become CEO chairman trying to save the Equitable. And they wanted my then boss, David Cipher, to move over, help with the demutualization of the company, and also build out the insurance practice. In those days, research and banking worked hand in glove. And so we were part of that team. I ultimately got my own sector to cover the asset management and brokerage industry, which I did for many years. And following that, well, Credit Suisse acquired DLJ. I went with the merger for a few years. And at the end of 2002, I left. I went to Bank of America as part of the management team, not a coverage analyst. Stayed there 4 years and joined Blackstone just as it was going public in 2007.
I'm not going to let you go to Blackstone just yet. So at DLJ, covering asset management, is asset management the way that we think about it today, or what was asset management then?
Yeah. So the total, I should broaden it. I really covered non-bank, non-insurance financials.
Okay.
So including some credit card companies, this is a whole mishmash. And I had worked on IPOs across the landscape, both brokerage, including Goldman Sachs and DLJ, as well as asset management companies. So they are the same as what you would think of today, although a lot of them don't even really exist in public form any longer, but they did not include at that time private equity or private real estate. You know, a lot of the companies that you would think of today as some of the biggest publicly traded asset management companies weren't public back then.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, so you were at DLJ and you were involved in taking involved in the IPO of DLJ,
yes,
which repeated itself a few
years later.
Okay, interesting.
It was a defining moment, really, for me in my career.
Interesting. And then you left DLJ, you went to B of A, but you said you were not in a research role any longer. What were you doing at
B of
A?
Research manager. So I was the head of equity research,
okay,
but I was not covering sector.
Sectors, okay. So 2007, Blackstone. How did you get to Blackstone? Did you find them? Did they find you? What was that like?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So Tony James was the president and COO of Blackstone at the time. He had been the president of DLJ and also at Credit Suisse. And Tony reached out to me and left a voicemail. Hey, you may have seen we filed to go public. We'd like to bring someone on who has financial services experience, capital markets, you know, all in all. I left a message back and said, how senior, junior, let me know. I know a lot of people. He left a voicemail back. We were missing each other, training calls. And he said, it really depends on the person. And he was a little more definitive in what he wanted. So I then left another message back and said, well, it sounds like you're literally describing my background. So if you're interested in talking to me, you know, I'd be interested in talking to you. That was the beginning of our discussion.
Wow. And so what was the process like? And did you know the role you were interviewing for a role, I presume, to help take the company public, since that's what you had done previously?
Yeah. So it ended up being a role that spanned shareholder relations, public affairs, and strategy. Initially, I did also have a role working on the IPOs of portfolio companies, but we pretty quickly hired someone to do that full time. So I always worked across all of Blackstone on various things. We looked at acquisitions, expansion, strategic plans for each of the businesses. But really, my most essential role when I joined the firm was to build out shareholder relations.
And so this is pre-2007, so it's just pre-GFC.
Correct.
What was Blackstone's size and scale at IPO?
So we managed $88 billion.
Okay.
Today, we're over a trillion.
Wow.
And the most often asked question was, you're the biggest alternative asset manager in the world. How will you possibly grow from here?
In 2007, $88 billion was the largest alternative asset manager in the
correct
world. Wow. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, amazing.
And how did you overcome that question?
And I would tell them. You know, we are, if you think about how Blackstone has continued to evolve, we'll continue to create new funds in interesting areas. We'll continue to scale our current areas. And it was also very early, even in how institutional investors were allocating to private investments. It was only about 5% of the portfolios in U.S. pension funds. Today, it's north of 20%. Mm-hmm. So it was still quite early in the secular trend upward.
Interesting. And so as you think about your role and the different hats that you've worn since 2007, you started in, it sounds like corporate strategy. Is that the right? Shareholder relations, corporate strategy. What came after that?
So I did a bunch of other stuff here that probably feels like it doesn't fit, but ultimately about 8 or 9 years ago, I was asked to lead the private wealth business and really build it out into the global leading business of its kind. So that's what I've been doing since then.
And what was the vision? How was that presented to you? I mean, was this an obvious thing? I mean, today, private wealth, and we're going to spend a lot of time digging in, is, you know, it's in the headlines. It's the huge opportunity. You guys are at the top of, you know, the pyramid here. But 8, 9 years ago, help us kind of paint the picture.
Yeah. So the business started before me, and okay, I was involved in thinking about the strategy around it, in interviewing the gentleman that we initially hired to build it out. And the thought process was as follows. We had about 5% of our assets under management with individual investors, but it was largely friends and family. And we went on a listening tour with some of the largest distribution partners and just asked, like, in order to really scale something, what would we need to do on our side to be able to service you? And that sparked the framework and what ultimately became the private wealth business. But initially, we were distributing pieces of the drawdown funds. We still do that today. So those are 10-year funds. You commit your money up front, gets invested typically over 4 years, money back. You know, flash forward today, that's very different, where you have open-ended funds, perpetuals, you know, much more prevalent. But the vision back then was, you know, this doesn't exist in scale, and we could bring Blackstone quality to individual investors and give them a better experience than what they've had in the past. That was the idea behind it.
And on the listening tour, what did you hear? I mean, did you hear that financial advisors and their clients really were clamoring for access to private markets? Or was it a bit of an education where they didn't quite know that they needed it, and then you have to provide access, and then you had to educate them of kind of the intersection of why that access makes sense in their portfolio?
It's really all of the above.
Okay.
Right? Not one size fits all. So I would say a lot of the top advisors did want more access, but there was always a cynicism around, you know, why are you coming to us? And so what they really wanted to know was that this was a commitment, that we weren't just showing up, selling a product and disappearing, that we would be there to service, that we would be transparent, that we would work with advisors and the like. And, you know, if you think about, you know, how you choose a financial advisor, how you choose an asset management company, of course, performance is important, but trust actually ranks number one.
And what did you have to do to establish trust? I mean, Blackstone was obviously a trusted entity. You were a public entity at that time. But what does that mean to be trusted?
That means actually building out a business where you have high quality individuals who are dedicated to serving the advisor. So today it's a much bigger business, but if here it's everything from product development to sales, wholesalers, the desk, investor services, marketing, education, all of the pieces, and just bringing all of those resources to bear. And the education lift is significant. It is still significant. It's very much the 80-20 rule. And the majority of advisors across the US and certainly around the world have still never allocated any of their client assets to privates. So we do see that changing, but we have a long way to go.
So today, you oversee Blackstone's private wealth business globally, correct?
Correct.
What does that look like? Describe the business, the scale in terms of, you know, whatever you're willing to share, whether it's maybe like, let's talk about the scale of the business. What does that mean from a team design? And, you know, how do you think about the headline numbers, whether it's assets under management or, you know, whatever metrics you use to describe the business?
Yeah. So today we have $250 billion, a little more in assets under management. So it's quite large. You would argue that's probably bigger than most of our competitors in total. So definitely a large amount of assets. We have about 300 people around the world servicing advisors. We are still growing. I think we can be multiples of that as I look out. And our team will continue to grow in order to service that as well.
So for our listeners who hear retail capital, private wealth, they hear all these buzzwords, they read them in the headlines. How would you describe private wealth today in terms of the different ways that individuals and their advisors can access alternatives? Like what's the landscape?
Yeah. So, and I'll use the US as an example. Sure. It used to be that you had to have $5 million or more to access most private investments. And that's a shame because most of the investments in the world are private.
Right.
90% of companies, 90% of commercial real estate. And if you were below that, the products that were out there were, I would say, not terribly high quality for the most part. Of course, there's always exceptions. Today, there are non-traded REITs, there are which have private real estate. There are BDC structures, which have private credit and other structures like interval structures also. There are open-ended private equity funds, and those have different accreditation. So you may still need to be a qualified investor for some, but there are many more options for many more individuals.
And when you think about, you described your team as servicing advisors. And so I think that's an important distinction because some people in their brains think about going direct to the individual. So help me understand kind of why have you made a decision to work with the advisors? And do you go direct to the individual or is all your business done through the advisors today?
It's really through the advisors.
Okay.
If I go all the way back in time when we thought about the strategy, we considered all options. And so, you know, we are designed to service the advisor. And I think it was very natural because we had been very well set up on the institutional side, servicing in very much the same way. So it's all about educating, communicating, just making sure we're in front of people. It's not about being product salespeople. I don't have anyone here paid on commission. We're just trying to partner with advisors, figure out what the solutions are, and if something we have fits or not.
I think it's interesting because when we talk to people about the market, one of the big challenges is this idea around advisor or investor education, because the point you just made, right? It's all about fitting a solution to a client's needs. As you think about kind of the persona of an advisor, you know, a lot of investment managers are like, oh, advisors, they're, you know, they have a lot of money. They can allocate that money to my fund. But what else have you learned about kind of what is important to advisors and thus to their clients? Because I don't think people really understand that dynamic.
It's such a good question. And I'll give you a live example. I met with an advisor and he's probably one of our biggest allocators now. But he told me he had never had any private investments in his client portfolios. Someone else in his branch, he works for one of the big firms in the US, suggested he meet with one of our guys in the field. And he took the meeting and he said it totally changed his thinking because he learned about the asset classes, how they fit in the portfolio, how they act as diversifiers. But probably as essential, our wholesaler went with him to meet with clients. And after five or six of those meetings, he had the confidence to be able to talk about it himself. But there's probably no way he would have allocated without that confidence. And I completely get it. So when we speak about education, it's not just the formal education of teaching about the structure and the investments. It's also how do you answer the questions and how do you talk about it to your clients in a simple way so that they'll really understand all the way around. And that's what we do. To me, the day-to-day meeting with advisors is probably the most essential part of the education process. And I'll quote another advisor who said, when ETFs came out, those were considered like exotic and a lot of advisors didn't use them. He utilized that as a tool to get new clients. And he would meet with clients and say, is it on purpose that your advisor has no ETFs in your portfolio? And today says, is it on purpose that your advisor has no private investments in your portfolio? These will become essential building blocks to a well-diversified portfolio.
And so for in this, if I take that instance to the next extreme of the example, that advisor then has access presumably to your products, maybe yes. others, and they can use that as a competitive advantage vis-a-vis their peers and presumably take assets under advisement from a different bank branch advisor, bring it over to theirs and then invest across alts. Am I thinking about that the right way?
You are exactly right.
How do you think about the future and how do you think about scaling the size of your distribution, your sales force with the opportunity that you see? Do you just need to keep adding people because this is manual, or do you see some inflection point where maybe the level of education starts to change where you can have fewer people and achieve more scale? Or is it not about scale at all?
So the way I think about it, it's not just sales, and we will be building out every area of our business because you can't have a car without its engine. So investor services is critical. These aren't like buying stocks and bonds, having someone to answer questions, et cetera. Certain areas will scale through technology over time, but you do need, I believe, talented individuals, knowledgeable individuals out there. And we will be adding more people out in the field, not just in the US, but everywhere around the world. So when I meet with heads of private wealth organizations or heads of private banks or CEOs of banks, they ask us for more. Will you come in and train our people? They want their advisors utilizing these tools. And so they need someone who's probably the expert in all of the asset classes, and that's Blackstone, to come in. So for one bank, for example, we've been doing what we're calling alternatives bootcamp. And it's the essentials of private equity, of private real estate, private credit, absolute return, and the like. And we do that everywhere we go. And you need resources for that.
And what makes a great member of your sales or advisor education team? Like, what are the, you know, when I think about my friends and peers in the industry who are selling institutional products, they're wonderful. But, you know, our business spans both institutional and non-institutional. And I often feel like when I'm talking to the institutional allocators on the LP side and the GPs, they're speaking one language. And when I talk to my clients who don't work with institutional capital, it's an entirely different language. So have you found that you can, there's a lot of crossover between Blackstone's institutional teams, or have you looked for a different kind of profile or different type of person?
Yeah, different profile. I think you can transport someone from the institutional side over, but the key is to have real depth and command, but also to be able to simplify it. And, you know, give you an example. If you're in a 45-minute meeting and you're trying to cover every single asset class, and that's pretty tough. And so listening and understanding what the advisor needs, I think, is important, and then really going all in on that. The difference on the institutional side is often you're having someone go in who is meeting with the head of real estate. So they're just going to focus on real estate, or the head of private equity, however that institution's set up. And here, we're generalists and they're generalists, but they're also generalists beyond privates, right? They're looking at everything. They're looking at a lot of different managers. So we need to provide value. We need to be succinct, and we need to be substantive.
So we talked about the platform, Blackstone, the products. You mentioned before it started with the traditional drawdown closed-end funds. We now have interval funds. We have registered products. What is the product suite that Blackstone has today for private wealth?
So we have, in addition to offering all of our drawdown funds, which we still do, We have open-ended funds in real estate, in private credit, in absolute return, which used to be called hedge funds, now is absolute return, and private equity. We also recently introduced an open-ended fund in infrastructure. So really the full suite. But if clients also want the closed end for life sciences or secondaries or global private equity, global real estate, we offer that as well.
What are you seeing in the difference between, you know, a closed end fund is illiquid by design, right? Open end fund has more flexibility. How do you see demand changing for the different product types that you offer?
I think the path of travel is moving towards open-ended because your money is invested right away. Even though there are caps to the liquidity, there is liquidity available. And you're giving up something on return for that liquidity sleeve, but it's pretty efficient liquidity. But there are others who prefer the drawdown and to manage their own liquidity. So I'll just give an example. If you are a private equity investor and you are looking for, you know, that high teens return, 10-year fund, probably, you know, a little more than double your money, say. But if you're an open-end investor and that fund achieves just 12% net, over 10 years, you will triple your money because the money's in the ground day one. And so the compounding effect, I think, is very compelling to folks. So we are seeing movement in that direction.
And I've heard people say that, you know, a liquidity is a feature, not a bug. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with that phrase, but how do you, you know, you've just highlighted a perfect example of why liquidity can be beneficial, but do you believe that there's a scenario where having illiquid product is actually a benefit, or how do you think about that?
I think it partly depends on the asset class. Certain asset classes just aren't right for an open-ended fund. One example might be like our life sciences business, where largely funding phase three trials. Initially, there's not a lot of money going in, so you would have idle cash. It's really when you can have a flow business and you have a wide enough aperture on investments that I think the open end makes sense. So, of course, I like our funds more than I like others' funds, but that's how we really have thought about it. And meaning that money coming into real estate, we really have set up our real estate investing arm to be able to quickly deploy that. The same in private credit. Blackstone's, if not the biggest, certainly one of the biggest, you know, major network, and we're able to source our own origination. And, you know, the same with the other strategies. So I think that's really key. Not everything fits in an open-ended, and I don't think every firm is really capable of generating the kind of flow that will make that an interesting opportunity for the long term. And I think this is really important. Perpetual means forever, if you will. So where you want to be careful is you don't want to create a fund that just because you think you can raise a lot of money today, and then the opportunity set disappears in a few years, and you're stuck with all this capital. That would not be a great client experience. And so we think about what's enduring. Do we have the right team? Will this deliver a good net return for clients over a very long period of time? And that has fed into how we think about product creation.
So when you think about product creation, not in terms of the product structure, but in terms of the asset classes that you're investing into, let's move forward and talk about kind of what is Blackstone, or what are you most excited about based on where you see this demand for duration?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Again, one size doesn't fit all. So there are a lot of different flavors to it. But if you think about the private wealth investing industry and how it's evolved over many years, when I started in the business, financial advisors were called stockbrokers, right? Because they were picking stocks. That then evolved to choosing asset managers, and the path of travel is really moving towards creating portfolios, portfolio allocations, whether it's discretionary model portfolios. And by and large, private investments have been left out of that because it's clunky today. But I believe that's where it's going. And I just think these are going to be basic building blocks. And those are massive pools of assets that are in need of high quality private investments. And so these firms are going to want to partner with asset management companies like ours that can provide real scale across a number of asset classes to be able to fulfill those needs.
And so for your own products, was your real estate, was BREIT the first product for private wealth that was offered? What was the sequencing? And you mentioned you have, you know, a new one coming or some new ones, but kind of what was the sequencing of the products that you launched?
So BCRED was the first real scale. Oh, excuse me, BREIT. You're right.
Okay.
BREIT. We have so many acronyms here. It's like hard to keep them straight. But yes, real estate was the first. Credit came next. Private equity after that. And infrastructure followed suit.
So I think there's some inherent, you know, we're talking about this and obviously the opportunity, and Blackstone is at the top of its game and the leader in this space by, I think, a long mile. What are some of the challenges, right? I mean, this isn't, you know, I don't think this is the overnight success. You've been at this as a firm for quite a while. And we can either talk about it in the construct of challenges or lessons learned. You know, I'll follow your lead, but kind of what can we take away that might inform how we're going to go forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I love the way you framed it, because from the outside in, folks think like, oh, this has happened so quickly, but we've been doing it for like 13, 14 years. So it didn't quite happen that quickly. But now today, obviously, it's a big scale business and growing. In terms of the path forward and just even thinking about some of the challenges, I think it's really, how do you maintain the same level of care, the same level of service while servicing a much larger group of advisors? So we're often rethinking what we're doing and how we're doing it. And I believe we're about to launch on yet another big growth spurt, not just because of the secular growth, but cyclically, I think you'll see a movement from cash to investments, particularly if short-term rates come down and cash isn't earning all that much. So we are thinking through everything that we're doing. How are we educating? How are we servicing? How are we in the field? And we think about it everywhere in the world. In terms of some of the lessons learned, you know, I think some of it is just that this isn't easy for advisors. And that's a big deal. It may not be the most exciting thing to talk about, but the investor services piece and the technology piece, those are friction points. And so I try to think through what are all of the areas of friction that we can work through. And I think the other lesson learned is just how much more we have to go on education. You know, it's when we first arrived in the market, because we were the reference institution for the big institutional investors, I think there may have been an assumption that everyone knows who Blackstone is and what we do and what we offer. And that really wasn't the case. Much more known today, but not everywhere in the world. So a lesson around that. And, you know, I don't know. I think we've been able to just go from strength to strength, really. Not too many stumbles.
And it's interesting because I hold Blackstone in such high regard for a lot of reasons, but one area that I talk about this a lot is your communication strategy. And, you know, we're doing a podcast here in your office, for example. Not yeah. every asset manager is open to this. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And so do our listeners. But if I think about kind of the way that and this is my observation, so you can correct me or maybe tell me if it's intentional or not. But the way that I think about your communication, the way that I think about you and the rest of the executive leadership team show up on LinkedIn, on social media, have a point of view, it feels to me very authentic. It feels like it's coming yeah. from you, not from, you know, a corporate communications team.
Yeah.
Was that deliberate? Because I always point, you know, I was joking with one of your colleagues before we started. I remember the day that John Gray set up his LinkedIn profile and it made me angry because I've been on LinkedIn for 15 years. I had like 10,000 followers. I think he had 150,000 in 15 minutes. But what's really impressive is not the profile and what you've done. And I, you know, I followed a lot of your content as well, but it's the way that you handle it. So talk to me about that communication strategy and how you think about that.
So that was my own personal preference. I said I'd be happy to go on LinkedIn, but only if I could write my own content, which of course goes through proper channels and approving, you know, but I wanted it to be authentic and I wanted anyone checking out my profile to get a sense of me as a person in addition to me as a Blackstone professional. That was the idea behind it. I believe John Gray really adopted the same approach, which is we are humans, we're just people, and you should get to know us in that way. So we tend to mix what's happening here, real, I think, very strong content around what we're seeing in our portfolio companies or properties and share that intellectual capital, but also give you a window into what's actually happening in our lives a little bit.
I hope that our listeners take that to heart because I do think that there's a lot more authenticity that we can bring to the investment landscape. And, you know, like you said, we're all human. So I applaud you for doing that. That's a great,
thank you.
Great benefit to all of us who get to follow your content. So let's transition a little bit to leadership and kind of your philosophy. I've read a few articles about and track some of the work that you're doing in terms of promoting diversity and women in leadership roles, specifically on Wall Street and in finance. You know, perhaps for some, at least historically, the path not most traveled, least traveled, but it's changing. It's changed a lot. What are some of your interests and how are you having an impact? You know, how do you focus your energy on having an impact in this area in particular?
So in that area in particular, I have to admit that earlier in my career, it was not a focus. I landed on Wall Street knowing that most of my colleagues were male colleagues. I didn't really give it all that much thought, truthfully. And it wasn't until later in my career when I would walk into a room and think, like, why aren't there other women in here? And how do we get more of them here? We really expanded our outreach and education, recognized that a lot of women didn't understand they could have very successful careers here. There were a whole number of things that have changed. And today, that's much more evenly split than it was. I will always happily mentor anyone who wants to be mentored. If I see something, I say something. And for example, if there's a woman presenting and I notice she's not speaking up afterwards, I will talk to her and say, like, you need to speak loudly in that room. You never want someone to say, like, oh, what did she say? Which is pretty common for women. And, you know, I wrote an article now many years ago, Truths for My Daughter, and thinking about what are the positive stories that we can share. A lot of these efforts had focused on the derailers and what goes wrong and what women aren't doing. But I had seen real success, including at Blackstone, of senior leaders, female senior leaders. And why not take those experiences and share those? And so that's been my approach, which is a much more positive approach, I believe.
So I did read that article before this interview, and one of the kind of lines was get comfortable being uncomfortable. What does that mean? What was intended by saying that, if you remember?
Yeah, I know. I remember it very well. What I think what that really means is it doesn't matter if you don't feel confident or you don't think you have all of the skill set. You should still go for it because it's learnable. And if you're only going to take roles that are an exact replica of what you've done previously, like how will you ever grow in your career? So in order to really grow, you have to be uncomfortable. And I was uncomfortable when I joined Blackstone, right? I had never held those roles. I was uncomfortable when I took on my current role. I didn't know much about the private wealth business. And I encourage others to do the same. And you know, you also have had an unconventional path. It's interesting, it's rewarding, but it doesn't mean you knew everything about each role until you were in the role and figured it out.
Still figuring it out. I think we all are, but at least I am. And I love that. So this opportunity in front of us around private wealth is absolutely massive. And as we look forward over the next 5 to 10 years, you know, Blackstone has this market leadership, but so many people, every meeting I'm in, everyone, I want to be like Blackstone. I want to be like Blackstone. Maybe take off your Blackstone, I want to, you know, we're the winner's hat, and put on your mentorship hat. What advice would you give for people listening to this podcast or watching us who see the same opportunity, but they're sitting there and it seems so hard. It seems like, how could I ever do what Blackstone's done? Because they're up here and I'm just a small little, you know, investment manager down here. Any kind of lessons or advice that you might give as people start on this journey to figure out how to be relevant in this new era?
Yeah, I mean, I know firms say they want to be Blackstone. And not everyone is going to be able to be Blackstone, right? Like, I would love to be able to invent the next Apple Watch, and I'm probably not going to be able to do that. So I would say focus on where your strengths really are and go all in on that. But invest in all areas to be able to service it. And don't just give it lip service. So I will say where I see gaps of peers is that they want to be in the private wealth space because they think they can raise a lot of money, but the firms are not committed enough to hire enough people and have real scale. And so the ability to actually service advisors well isn't there. Or they choose structures, again, that are designed to maximize asset gathering, but not designed to maximize net investor return. I think that's a mistake that over time will show itself. So I just think if you're committed, be committed to delivering a product that's really high quality, that's well thought out, and that you're able to match with truly excellent service. So as you know, like, what distinguishes one business from another? It's going to be the investment performance, it's the brand, it's the trust, it's the quality of the people, it's the process that you have. How are you delivering it? How are you motivating people? What are your ethics? And I just think the standard of care in private wealth has to be exceptionally high.
So I want to wrap up with two quick questions. The first is, what is one misconception about Blackstone that you hear most frequently that we should debunk during this episode?
Oh, that's a good question. You probably hear more about Blackstone than I do. But maybe one misperception would be, oh, Blackstone's just focused on asset gathering. And I will tell you, the asset growth is really an outcome. It's not the input. On my team, we don't have, you know, asset targets. And I said, like, we're not motivating people with commissions or anything like that. It's really, if you deliver a high quality product, you treat your customers well, they will want to allocate more assets to you.
Second question, what's one thing that we, our listeners, may not know about you if they're looking on your LinkedIn, they're reading your biography on the Blackstone page? One thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's, you know, my life is like your life. I try to weave a lot in it. So in addition to work, I do have a lot of interest in not-for-profits, sit on some not-for-profit boards. I love running. I actually just did the New York City Marathon with my brother-in-law after not doing it for many years. We did it as a run walk, which I have to say was so much more pleasant than the last time around. And my little fun fact, which I didn't think was that fun, but people are always surprised when I say it, is I've never had a cup of coffee in my entire life.
What?
Yeah, I know. I know.
That's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I've had three for you today. So, and it might not be my last one. That's unbelievable. That's a great.
Yeah. First time I'm sharing that
Oh, and I appreciate publicly. And I appreciate you volunteering the fun fact, because people who know me, who have been to dinners that I host, I always ask for a fun fact.
Oh,
and you
funny.
Just did it totally yeah. unprompted. So thank you. That's wonderful. Well, Joan, we could go on forever. I really appreciate your time, your insights. Congratulations on what you've built. And thank you for what you're doing to help transform the markets. We think it's really exciting, and I'm excited to continue to track your progress.
Thank you very much. Very fun.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.